Thank you, Kim. All right, now it's my distinct pleasure to introduce our World Service speaker for the South Carolina Al-Anon Alateen Convention. JP, I've never met you in person, but I've seen you on many electronic meetings. I feel like I know you forever non-professionally. And I see from your bio that you're a firm believer in service as a path to recovery. So without further ado, I would just like to introduce JPM, and the floor is yours, sir.
Thank you, Bob. Hi, I'm JP Marnick, a grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon Family Groups, which includes Alateen. You know, I remember the first time I heard somebody introduced that way, and I thought I would gag. I thought it was very pompous, but I'm awfully glad that I stayed around the program long enough to understand and to come to appreciate that introduction. I would like to thank the committee for inviting me back to the South Carolina Convention. I was invited to speak here once before in 2014. And I guess they either forgot, I either did okay or they forgot. So I don't know which. I do see some faces here that I recognize were there in 2014. As I tell my story, you can step out of the room for 30 minutes because the first half hasn't changed. I do it chronologically, so you can come and see what the update is since 2014. Thank you all for allowing me to tell my story. I always have mixed feelings about doing it because I'm an Al-Anon wimp. My life has been good. In fact, as I share my story, you may come to the opinion that if my life was that good, I wouldn't have needed Al-Anon. And that's okay if you feel that way, because I did too for 52 years. You know, with that, I'm going to go ahead and tell you my story. It's something where I'm the world's second leading expert on my life. And my wife, the leading expert on my life, my wife is not here at this convention, so I'm on my own. So thank you. When I was working, I work for a major corporation, and when we spoke to the executives, we had to present information in a particular way. It was a three-part way. Tell them what you're going to tell them. Tell them what you told them. Now, you listen better than they do, and I probably wouldn't have to do it that way, but I'm going to do it that way just out of habit. So here's what I'm going to tell you. I'm going to tell you about my family of origin and drinking. I'm going to tell you how to train a mule. I'm going to share my encounters with alcoholism, and I'm going to talk about my service experience. Relative to my family of origin, I am the luckiest, most loved and blessed person in the world. I was the eighth of nine children. When I was born, I had five older sisters between the ages of 6 and 13. And in those days, you know, you couldn't get a doll that would cry and wet its pants, you know, but I could do that. I could do that. So I had a lot of attention. I had, I was loved from the minute I came into this world, I have no doubt. And of course, like everything else in my life, I took that for granted for many, many years and didn't realize what a blessing it was. Like I said, my family, there were nine of us in our family, nine children. We were poor. My father probably never made over $3,000 a year, which would probably be about $38,000 a year today, and raised a family of nine on that. You know, frequently I was embarrassed and ashamed of the clothes that I wore, and that's kind of what I paid attention to. But the other thing about my early life, due to my position within the family, I became a natural detacher. In my family, we have a lot of leaders. We have a lot of leaders in my family. Now, as the eighth of nine, I was allowed to lead and absolutely nobody followed because they didn't want to take advice from their younger brother. But it was good because I did learn to detach. I learned that I could express my opinion and let it be. And that was very powerful. When I was a sophomore in high school, the religion I belonged to centralized a school in a small town. Now, my town where I lived was 6,000 people, but the school was in a town of 800 people. So we're talking small and very small. Now, I didn't particularly want to go to that school, but my parents didn't give me a choice. And in our family, you listen to the parents, not out of fear, but out of disappointing them in not returning the love that they always showed us. And I never thought of disobeying my parents just because I knew it would hurt them. And it was wonderful. Now, when I went to that school, I met a girl. I liked her. I liked her a lot. But economically, our families were very different. Her family was economically in the upper class, and my family was in the lower economic status. And it took me some amount of courage to invite her to my house because I had been to her house, and it was very wonderful, much different than mine. But you know, when I finally did get the nerve to ask her to come over to meet my family, she saw something else. She saw the love that was in my family, because my family is very open and loving. Her family was a very emotionally reserved. And so it was one of the first times I came to have any sense of appreciation and gratitude for what I had. You know, she helped me to see what I had rather than what I didn't have. And I thank her to this day for that experience. Now, after college, I got married. We had four kids. We moved a lot. I worked for a company whose initials stood for I'd been moved. And our sixth and final move was to Atlanta, where we still live. We moved here in 1975. I forgot to tell you, in my family of origin, there are teetotalers, users of alcohol, abusers of alcohol, and alcoholics. Now, at times in my life, I have been each of the first three at different times. I never made it to alcoholic. See, I didn't have the disease. In later years, when I abused alcohol, the pain and suffering that I created, I could not blame on a disease. I have to blame on stupidity. And if they ever start Stupids Anonymous, I'm going to sign up as a charter member, because that's what my drinking did. I added a lot of stress to my wife's life that she didn't need. So, but that was kind of a digression. Let me get back to where we are. We moved to Atlanta, as I said, in 1975. And shortly after we moved here, my wife's sister also moved here. Now, both of our families are from Iowa. So being in Atlanta, we were a long way away from family. Our our next closest relative was 400 miles away in Louisville, Kentucky. But Patty showed up. She showed up in Atlanta. Why she moved here, I have never known. But Patty was an alcoholic. She had been an alcoholic since high school. She had been in and out of treatment, God knows how many times. But she came into our life, and my wife was convinced. She really wanted to believe that she could make a difference in Patty's life, that she could find the way of expressing something that Patty would hear that had never been heard before. And that is when she started in Al-Anon. I don't know how she found Al-Anon, but she found it. And so she worked. Now, unfortunately, Patty was one that was never able to overcome alcoholism. And she died. I say she died on the streets of Atlanta. My wife said, no, it was not on the street. She was in a house. She was in a rooming facility when she died. You know, I said I was a natural detacher. When Patty's died, my reaction was, she is finally at peace. She has finally found the sobriety that she really wanted. She just didn't have. And so that was the way I reacted to her family. Now, my wife stayed, excuse me, my wife stayed in Al-Anon, and she read, she had all the literature. My wife has a great library. And so she would leave the literature in the bathroom where I do a lot of my reading. And so I had read a ton of Al-Anon literature before I came into the program. So what brought me into the program? Well, you know, we don't have qualifiers in Al-Anon, but as my wife expresses it, we all have a beloved alcoholic, because that's why we're here. We love an alcoholic, and the alcoholic that I love is my youngest son. You know, there's denial, and there's being oblivious. And we didn't deny our son's alcoholism. We were oblivious to it. I mean, he drank from the time he was 12 years old, and we became aware of it in his early 20s. He was good. He was going to a psychiatrist at the time for treatment of bipolar. And after literally years of treatment, the psychiatrist never realized he was an alcoholic. He was that good. So it wasn't so much denial as it was obliviousness. And you know, at that time, we were down to just the three of us. Our older children were off in college. They were seldom home at that point. So it was just my wife, my son, I'll call him Paul, the three of us living together. And it didn't go well, to say the least. It didn't go well. You know, I saw him drinking. I felt guilt for the way that I had modeled drinking to him. I felt frustration and anger because I had always been able to help my children become who they needed to be, but I couldn't fix Paul. And so it was a tremendous amount of guilt there. Now, I had read enough of the literature. Like I said, I had read enough of the literature to really have a head understanding that alcoholism was a disease. However, my heart kept telling me that it was a bunch of bad choices and he could do better if he just tried harder. Well, we know that's not the truth. And so I had this anger and frustration, and I knew I shouldn't direct it at him. And so I was stuffing it until, of course, it comes out sideways, and it came out sideways by me yelling at my wife. And when I looked at that, I came to understand that I qualified under step two because I had an insanity from which I needed to be restored. And so I only came to this program because of my insanity. If I hadn't had those insane actions, I wouldn't be here. But that's what brought me into the program, was the recognition that the way I was dealing with it was destroying my primary relationship. And so I started in Al-Anon. And that was in 1994. And I've been here ever since. Now, let me digress again to teach you about training the mule. Okay. How do you teach a mule to do what you want to do? Well, there was this guy who just bought a mule from the mule skinner, and he went out and got the mule and pulled him, and the mule did nothing. And the guy says, come on, let's go, come on. And the mule does nothing. And the guy goes back to the mule skinner and says, how do I teach him to obey me? He says, you whisper in his ear. Really? Yeah, you whisper in his ear. So he goes over and he whispers in the mule's ear. And he says, come on, let's go now. And the mule does nothing. So he goes back to the skinner and mule skinner and says, you know, I think I did something wrong. I misunderstood you. What do I do to teach him? He says, you whisper in his ear. Really? I whisper in his ear. Yep, whisper in his ear. So he goes back and he whispers in the mule's ear, and the mule does nothing. And he goes back to the mule skinner for the third time, and he says, geez, I'm just not getting this. It isn't working. Can you show me? And the mule skinner says, sure. And the mule skinner picks up a 2x4, goes over that mule, and just whops him on the head. And then he whispers in the mule's ear, come along, and the mule came along. And the guy says, wait, that's not fair. You didn't tell me about hitting him. And the guy says, well, that didn't teach him a thing. That just got his attention. And so sometimes my higher power has to get out that 2x4 before I will listen to that whispers. And as I go forward in my story, I think you'll see a few times where my higher power needed to hit me on the head with that 2x4. Now, life had really been good for a long time for me. But in the September of 1982, my wife got sick, and from September of 82 to early January of 83, she was in the hospital 50% of the days. And the other 50% of the days, she was incapable of doing very much. And so and where that disease ended up, I was sitting in her hospital room, waiting for her to get back from a treatment. And the doctor called and he said, there's a 95% chance that your wife will not be alive in 12 months. And that was the 2x4 on my head. And all the time that I took taking my wife and my life for granted, it all went away with that. And I looked and I saw what I had, not what I didn't have. Once again, I had to learn that gratitude. Now, I don't know how other people would react to finding out that their loved one is going to die in 12 months. After thinking it through for a while and trying to get to some level of acceptance, my decision was, if she's going to live for 12 months, I'm going to try to make those 12 months the happiest 12 months possible for her. And so we went on a cruise. We bought the dining room furniture that we had talked about getting for months or years. We did those things, but still there was this emptiness because I had this feeling that I had lost her. But I had come to the acceptance of the reality of her disease. And you know, it so often happens when we finally accept something, things change. And one of my sister-in-laws at that time was working at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And she had doctor friends there. And one of them said, get me all of the biopsies that they did on Jeannie and send them to me. They had been distributed to three different labs. Nobody had ever looked at all three of them together. And he looked at all three of them together and said, no, this is not pancreatic cancer. This is chronic pancreatitis. Now, chronic pancreatitis is associated with old alcoholic men, not one of which my wife qualifies, because she gets sick on two drinks. So she seldom drank, so it wasn't that. So best I can figure, she got it through marriage. Now, all of a sudden, this change that this person that I thought I was going to lose in 12 months has a very, very, very good chance of not dying. Of course, that left me with a dilemma. I had made the decision of how to treat her for 12 months. How should I treat her if she's going to live for 12 years or 20 years or 50 years? And I thought, it still was a good plan. It still was a good plan. And I would like to say I have carried it out to perfection ever since then. No, I did very well for a couple of years. But it's still, when I go back and I think about that, she'll be treated very well today, because I will have remembered what life looked like when I looked at what it would be without her in it. So I kind of jumped around there a little bit, because this occurred before we were aware of our son's alcoholism. With the three of us living together and me yelling at my wife and trying to be good to my son, things just weren't going well. And I am looking, I am searching. I'm finally in the program. He's in the program. He's in AA. We joined the same month. But I, new to the program, I still wasn't getting it. I knew a lot of things in my head and very few things in my heart. And so I kept trying to figure out, well, he got on the internet, met a girl in Boston, and moved to Boston to live with her and her family. Now, in all the things that I looked at, trying to figure out a solution to the dilemma of how we live together, I did not once consider Boston as part of the answer. Not once did I consider that. And what that taught me was, just because I don't see an answer doesn't mean there isn't an answer. It just means I can't see it, but my higher power can. And so that helps me to remember that in my worst days, when I can't see an answer, there is an answer available. Just go to the one that can see with better vision than I can. They say there's no geographical cure, but I'll tell you, If you move your alcoholic 1,000 miles away, he's a lot easier to live with. And so our life went on, and he stayed there in Boston, and we went to visit him. After he had lived there a year or two, we went to visit him. And like I said, he was living with his girl who became his wife and her family. And when we got there, I watched the interaction between my son and his future father-in-law. And I recognized that my son had a better relationship with his future father-in-law than he did with me. And that was very, very humbling, because I have always tried to have very good relationships with my children. And I looked at what was the difference. Why was there a difference? Well, what I came to the conclusion of, his future father-in-law accepted him just as he was. Not as he wanted him to be, not as he dreamed he would be, but as he was. And I was still looking for Paul to live up to my dream. But you know, it was my dream. It was never his dream. And when I could accept that, then we could improve our relationship. And we have. We do much better today. Excuse me. So we do much better today. Now, at this time, let me go back one step. When we first when we became aware of Paul's alcoholism, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer at that same time. You know, and so that was another one of those 2x4s. But you know, when I got prostate cancer, not a single person said, if you tried harder, you wouldn't have cancer. If you did better, you wouldn't have cancer. Yeah, not a single person said that to me. And if they wouldn't say that to me about my disease, I came to understand that I should not say that to my son about his disease. Because we just had different diseases. Mine happened to be more socially acceptable, but it was the same. So that was one of the lessons that I had to learn. And it helped to move that understanding from my head to my heart, to have some empathy and understanding with him. Now, our daughter later was diagnosed with breast cancer. And she was diagnosed in best I can remember, it was 2010, and she's doing very fine today and everything. But my wife and I and Paul went up to visit her, and the three of us, my wife and I and Paul, were at breakfast, and I had observed how my daughter and my son-in-law were dealing with my daughter's cancer with their children, how they were presenting them, how they were comforting the children. And their kids were 8 and 11. Well, that was approximately the age Paul was when my wife was so sick. And I saw how well they did, and I looked back at how poorly I did. See, when my wife was sick, I always thought that I was going to lose my wife. I did not adequately understand and help the children deal with the reality that they were looking at, that they were going to lose their mother. And from that, when the three of us were together in Indianapolis, in the Indianapolis area, I got a chance to make amends to my son and to talk to him and tell him how sorry I was that I was not more supportive of his feeling when his mother was in such a condition. Now, and so those are some of the things that have happened in my life that have helped me to better understand the program and to understand what it means. And so I'm going to switch over now to talking about the 11th step and my service experience. Now, I figured it out that I had heard the steps read at least 1,000 times before someone read step 11 with a little different inflection in his voice. And it said, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry it out. And I came to recognize that all this time I had been praying for understanding of his will. You know, why? If I have to do this, why? But see, that's not the question. The question is what? That's what we pray for. What does your higher power want you to do? What does my higher power want me to do next? See, if I have to understand it, then I'm really saying, God, I'll do what you want me to do as long as I agree with it. But that isn't what step three says. Step three says we turn it over. And so with just that one difference of understanding of that word in the 11th step, it changed my perspective of what to do and how to decide and what to do next. We try to live by do the next right thing. And so that's what guides my service today. And what started me down the path, you know, didn't start me down, but got me on the path to being a trustee went like this. My wife and I were coming home from our September assembly in 2008, and September of 2009 would be our next election assembly. And on the way home, my wife said, what are you going to stand for next year? I didn't have a clue. I did not have a clue. I didn't think that far ahead. I didn't know. And so I thought about it a lot, and I had come to the conclusion that if somebody I respected asked me to stand for a position, I would stand for it. So that was my plan for September of 2009. We went to the assembly in January of 2009, and our delegate, asked me and a few others to put in a resume to fill out the last year of the regional Southeast Region trustee position, which had been vacant for 2 years. And so I did. But you see, I got exactly the sign I asked for. I asked for somebody that I respected to suggest what I do. And I got exactly that sign. Now, the sign read very different from what I thought it would read, but that was it. So I submitted my resume and it gets pushed forward it came out of the region and I was a candidate for the region. I don't know if there was any other candidates. I might have won an election where I was the only candidate. But anyway, my name got put forward and so you're in this limbo waiting for the World Service Conference feedback to tell you whether or not you were selected. Well, due to the timing of our assemblies and the way the regional trustee submissions work, if I wanted a full term as the regional trustee, I had to submit my resume before I knew whether I got appointed the first time. So I submitted my resume, and the AWSC, who makes the decisions in this regard, didn't put my resume forward for the full term. they chose someone else. Well, coming home from that assembly, I got a phone call from the executive director at the time, Rick B. And he says, congratulations, you've been appointed to the one-year position. Welcome aboard. And I said, Rick, that's great. Thank you. Oh, by the way, my area is not putting my name forward for the full term. Now, I don't know if many of you know Rick B., but for 20 seconds, he was speechless, which is exceedingly unusual for Rick B. And then he said, well, then you'll just have to apply for trustee at large. And so I became a trustee. I went to the board meeting in July, which was an experience. I'll go back to that. And I had to, if I wanted to apply for the trustee at large, I basically had to apply right after that first board meeting, because the trustee at large resumes had to be in by August 15th. So I go to this first board meeting, and I am impressed. I am impressed with the members of the board. Holy cow. I thought they all had memorized the service manual, including the page numbers and the chapter headings. They could quote that thing. I couldn't believe it. But I go on, and I like it. So I decide I'm going to go ahead and submit my resume. Then I submitted my resume, and then I got to thinking, how am I going to feel if they don't select me? How am I going to feel? And so I struggled with that for a little while. That's measured in weeks. And then it dawned on me, from just that one board meeting, I knew how every one of them was going to vote. They were going to vote for what they considered to be best for Al-Anon. And you know, whether they elected me or not, knowing that that was the way they were going to vote, I was going to be able to live with the results. And you know, I hope you carry that forward to any time you stand for a position in Al-Anon. Stand, give your higher power a chance to make a choice. And assume that every one of those electors are going to vote for what they feel best for Al-Anon. And we should be able to live with those results. And so it no longer becomes a means of pride or friendship or anything else. It becomes what is best for Al-Anon. And that's a decision I can always live with. So that's how I got to be regional trustee for a year. And then I applied for the trustee at large position. And I did get elected for those 4 years. At this point, I had done some service. You know, I'd done all the group positions of us have. I was a GR, I was a DR. And I was, at the time I submitted my resume for that first board position, I was a district rep and the Alateen coordinator for Georgia, which in itself is another story, because, you know, being the Alateen coordinator or being a Alateen group sponsor is probably the most rewarding service position available in Al-Anon. If you want to come to an understanding of what your early life was like, especially if you grew up in alcoholism, become an Alateen group sponsor. My co-sponsors, I have three co-sponsors, the four of us take turns. The other three all grew up in alcoholic homes, and all of them have expressed how much they understand their own life because those kids shared their life. And so it becomes very important. And if you get that, if you get an opportunity to be that, if you qualify to be that, I really encourage you to be an Alateen sponsor. Let's see. I'm just going to go back and tell you about how did I get to be a GR and how did I start going to assembly? Just because it shows how my higher power leads me everywhere I go. My wife was the GR for our group. And it was our district's turn to host the hospitality room. And someone, I don't know if it was my wife or somebody else, said, you know, it'd really, really be helpful if we had someone at the assembly that could take care of the hospitality room while us GRs are in the business meeting. And so that's how I kind of got volunteered into going to my first assembly, was to be that. Of course, I went there and I can't say it was totally enjoyable. We were in a stage of some, let's say it wasn't our finest hour. Let's just leave it at that. It wasn't our finest hour. And so there was some unpleasant discord within it, but I got hooked on it. And so I stood for GR the next year, and my wife then became DR. So she was my DR and I was the GR, and life was good. And I was the Alateen. And then after she finished her term, I stood for DR because I wanted to finish some projects that she had started. And at that same time that I was the DR, the delegate asked me if I would be the Alateen coordinator for the whole state. And I said, yes. And now I had a problem with delegating stuff. But when I became both the DR and the area coordinator at the same time, I realized that I couldn't do it all. And I told the GRs in our group, if you want it done, you're going to have to volunteer to do it because I cannot do it all. And what I learned from that is not only shouldn't I, you know, I shouldn't do it all. It's not good for me. But, you know, it also isn't good for the other person. Because if I did it all, they would not have had a chance to grow. And they grew. And they were outstanding GRs. And, you know, somebody moved on to be the next DR and things. And they're very active to this day. And so I saw that trying to do too much isn't good for me and it isn't good for the other person. And that's a lesson I hadn't learned up to that point. Let's see, did I cover everything you want to say, ask me about it? You know, I got myself out of order here, so I have to find out where I am in my life. Okay, well then I guess at this point I'm on the board. I'm a trustee, and that's an incredible experience. And if you ever get a chance and you're in a position where you can do it, it does take time, apply for it, try it. The experience of trying it for it is one thing. But it's great. It's taken me to places I never expected to be. My favorite one is I got to go to the International Al-Anon General Service Meeting, the IAGSM, in Cape Town, South Africa. you know, like Boston, Cape Town was never on my expectation list, but it did. But I finished then 4 years as a trustee. The 1 year as the regional trustee and 3 years as the trustee at large. And then people asked me to, some of the board members asked me to apply to be a member of the executive committee. And I thought about it and I prayed about it. And I never got the answer. I never got that the answer was yes. So I did not apply for an executive committee position in 2013. Now in 2013, we had the International Convention in Vancouver, British Columbia. And because I wasn't on the board, my wife and I had the opportunity to take a leisurely drive from Vancouver back to Atlanta. And we stopped in Iowa, where many of my family members live, and got a chance to celebrate one of my sisters in the convent, and she was in the convent for 60 years at that point. So I got to stop and and share that experience with her. And my brother, my next older brother, was there. And I didn't know it at the time, but that would be the last time that I spoke to him while he was alive, while he was conscious. If I had been on the executive committee, I would have had to have been in Virginia Beach that week. So I didn't, and I got to that. At the time of the October board meeting, we got told that my brother was dying and if I wanted to see him to come. And so we went back to Iowa. I got to hold my brother's hand and tell him that he had done a good job and to go in peace. And he died that night. And I wouldn't have been able to be there if I had been on the board. In January, my daughter's father-in-law died very unexpectedly. And because I wasn't on the executive committee, we were able to go there and provide support for my daughter and her husband and our grandchildren who had just lost their favorite grandfather. And so we were able to do that. And I couldn't have done that if I'd been on the executive committee. So once again, God's plan, God's timing, God's vision is overwhelmingly right. You know, it's overwhelming what he can see that we can only guess at. And we don't even guess at it because we can't even see far enough to guess. But he took care of it. So that was 2013. I didn't apply. I applied in 2014. Just for some reason, I got the idea that I got the feeling that I should submit my resume. I submitted it, and I was not elected. And that's okay, because my higher power said to submit it. He didn't say I was going to win it. Yeah, you know? He didn't say I was going to be selected. He just said submit it. Again, what does he want me to do? I don't have to understand why he wants me to do it. In 2015, I applied for the executive committee. This time I got it. 2016, they're one-year terms. 2016, I applied for the executive committee. I did not get it. And then 2017 and 2018, I did get it. And so, and now in last year, once again, our region was short of a regional trustee. So I applied, and that's how I got to be the Southeast Regional Trustee one more time. And I think I'll hold the record for most times in and out by the time I finish this year. But you know, my higher power always led me to do these things. And sometimes it came out where I was selected, and sometimes it came out that I wasn't. But all of it was okay. All of it was right for whatever the situation was. And that's what I find today in in my life with my higher power and trying to find that guidance, that step 11, that step 11 tells us to do. Pray only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And that power is awesome. In my life, that power is awesome. And it's at work every day. If I go all the way back to my family of origin and how I started, my higher power was taking care of me then, even when I was not aware of it. So with that, I'm going to kind of conclude. I want to just tell, I told you I would tell you what I was going to tell you. And I'll tell you, and I'm going to tell you what I told you, right? I talked about my family of origin and the love and caring that I received there. I didn't tell you this, but you know that girl that I struggled to take to my visit my parents? When I got into college, well, I told you I'm loved. I'm also smart and lucky. See, when I was in college, I was smart enough to ask that girl to marry me. And I was lucky enough that she said yes. And in June, we will celebrate 58 years of marriage. And she has been one of the biggest, she has a tremendous blessing in my life. And we're both in the program. I'll show you what both of us being in the program can look like. We had this greeting card that I received from my wife. And it said, today, this is the outside cover. Today, I love you more than yesterday. And you open it up on the inside, it says, yesterday, you really pissed me off. well, that card went back and forth for many years. Now, I have lost track of it. I have a suspicion that she still has it somewhere. But that's what life in this program can look like. You know, you can tell the other person that they irritate the hell out of me, but I still love you. Yeah, but I still love you. And so that was it. You know, I hope you saw that I love all my children in a very special way. I love my beloved alcoholic, my son, Paul. I love Al-Anon and Alateen. It's a program. I don't know if it saved my life, but my son is alive and I'm not in prison. You know, so I've learned to deal with him much better. You know, but the overall love of this is what my higher power does for me every day of my life. And it did before I was aware of it. And then now I have a perspective to go back and appreciate what I paid no attention to. I hope I have learned from the whispers of my higher power. And I know at times he has to get the 2x4 to get my attention, because I have a short attention span at times. I didn't talk about the world. I usually talk about the World Service Conference structure, but that's this afternoon's workshop, so I won't do that. I told you how to train a mule, right? So if you ever get a mule, you got that down. So I think I've covered everything. I think that's what I covered today. I thank you for your attendance and attention. And I'll just close by saying what it says in our closing: take what you like and leave the rest. Thank you.